I'm Aaron Henkin, and this is Midday. An urban transformation is underway, and smart streets are at the heart of it. These are the words of Samuel Schwartz, a man who spent two decades as New York City's traffic commissioner and managed to walk away from the experience an optimist. He's just written a book titled Street Smart, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars. And he joins us this hour with a look back at how city streets were taken over by cars and how those streets are beginning to get reclaimed by pedestrians and bicyclists. Also joining us this hour, urban planner and architect Klaus Philipson for a look at transportation possibilities and problems here in Maryland. Our state just got a grade of D on its transportation report card, and it's time for a parent-teacher conference. Join us on Midday right after the news. Welcome to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Sheila Cast. Good to have you with us. We are your public radio. Midday is your daily public affairs forum. And so an invitation here at the top of the hour. This is a place for dialogue and interaction. And I want to invite you listeners into the conversation during the hour ahead. Join us with your thoughts, your questions, your hopes, your frustrations at 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I mentioned frustrations because our topic this hour is transportation, and I suspect there are many of you out there who are perhaps less than 100% satisfied with how our state is handling the issue. Who knows? Maybe you're stuck in traffic listening right now. 410-662-8780, the number to call, or email us at midday@wypr.org. So transportation has been a contentious issue here in Maryland in the last year. In June, Governor Larry Hogan effectively killed the Red Line. That's a 14-mile light rail project that was supposed to connect the east and west sides of Baltimore County through Baltimore City. His decree came down after years of planning. Millions of dollars of research went into the project. And I guess something of a transportation consolation prize came through last month when the administration announced a $135 million plan to transform Maryland's current bus system into a more integrated plan with 12 color-coded routes. But is that going to be enough? Is that going to be enough to make Baltimore a street-smart city? Just yesterday, the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance gave Greater Baltimore's Transportation Network a report card, the grade D. The report says jobs are too far away from transportation hubs, and only 11% of jobs take less than an hour to reach by public transportation. This report also points out that the Baltimore area has the sixth worst average commute time of all metropolitan areas in the nation, 31 minutes that the average commuter spends And that equals 47 hours in traffic every year. Joining me a bit later this hour is going to be Midday regular Klaus Philipson, urban planner and architect here in Baltimore with Archplan, Inc. We're going to take a look at that report card, and we're going to take your calls as well. But first, a few words with an unlikely traffic optimist, a man who spent two decades as New York City traffic commissioner and somehow managed to walk away from that experience feeling good about the future of urban transportation. These days, Sam Schwartz is a columnist for New York City's Daily News, a blogger for PBS and Engineering News Record, and he's just written the book Street Smart, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars. Sam joins us from a studio connection in New York. And Sam, welcome to Midday.
Nice to be here, Aaron.
Sam, I want to start just by asking out of pure curiosity, what makes a kid want to grow up to be a traffic commissioner?
Well, he's got to have a big brother. I started out as a physicist, and my big brother, who's a physicist, said, you know, why would you spend your career in physics? And he said, you're pretty good in math and science. What do you like? And I said, cities. And he put it into an equation. And he came out with, just like in a scene in The Graduate, instead of plastics, he said traffic. And that's how I became a traffic engineer and led to my career as New York City's traffic commissioner.
And you started from, I guess you might say, an entry-level position, maybe the equivalent of washing dishes in the restaurant industry. You started as a cabbie, right?
That's right. In the mid to late 60s, I was a cab driver, so I now have about a half-century perspective on transportation, certainly in the New York area, but I've studied transportation around the country and around the world.
Your book, Street Smart, it starts with a trip back in time, a trip to the early 20th century, an era when city streets belonged to pedestrians and horses and horse carts. I wonder if you might tell us the story of what those streets were like and then how they changed with the advent of the Ford Model T.
Sure. If we go back, say, 120 years, and it's the late 19th century, and we're on the cusp of a new century, and there are horse-drawn carriages everywhere, horse-drawn omnibuses, and somebody comes out with this newfangled invention, the automobile, and it's so clean because it doesn't leave droppings, and it seems to be so efficient. And we buy that line hook, line, and sinker. And the first 20 years of the 20th century were incredibly bloody because we had no definition as to who was on the roads, who controlled the roads. And pedestrians for centuries, for eons, were king and queen of the roads. And along came the car. And suddenly pedestrians had to walk in right angles and be confined to sidewalks. And they weren't used to that. So the car at the turn of the 20th century was really just used by some wealthy people and farmers because it made sense in rural areas. It wasn't until Henry Ford came out with the Model T that the working man could afford a car. And they didn't talk about working women in those days. So we saw post-1908 a huge growth in car ownership, a bloody two decades to start off the 20th century on the roads. And that growth just continued and continued until, of course, the Great Depression. We saw a bit of a drop then, but then it continued to grow throughout the century.
And, you know, that the motto is that the pedestrian has the right of way, but politically economically, that went out the window, really, with the ascendancy of the automobile, right?
With the ascendancy of the automobile, what we saw is pedestrians were relegated to be second or third class citizens. We saw communities evolve that have no sidewalks. We saw these very wide boulevards that don't even take into account that there are pedestrians trying to cross the street. And we still see high pedestrian fatality rates in lots of states. I think Delaware, right next to Maryland, is about the bloodiest, along with Florida, in terms of pedestrian fatalities. Still, car fatalities are one of the leading causes of children fatalities. And the same thing with the aged. Older people are more likely to be hit by cars than any other group.
Sam, walk us closer to the present now. Talk about, you know, we mentioned this long ascendancy of the automobile, really, over the past century. But you see that beginning to change now in our attitudes about cars.
Yes. So if we look at the growth in what traffic engineers refer to as vehicle miles traveled, VMT, how the sum of all the driving in the country, VMT went up unabated except for the Great Depression, World War II, but immediately rebounded after that. Post-World War II, we saw a couple of blips during the fuel crises of the 70s, but then it continued and continued to grow. And then something we hadn't seen since the advent of the car, somewhere around 2003, 2004, and nobody seemed to notice this, but VMT started to level off in the country. And then it started to go down. For 10 consecutive years in the United States, VMT went down. People were driving less. This preceded the Great Recession, accelerated through the Great Recession, and continued after the Great Recession. And only in the late 2014 and 2015 do we see a rise, but still per capita VMT is down 6 to 7% from what it was. So this was an oddity. It's nothing short of a revolution So people like myself were yes, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to ask you, why? Is there any attributable reason? Economic, social, cultural?
Yeah. There's no one particular reason, but there is one particular group that's driving less. And those are the millennials, those born after 1982. And they're not just driving 1 or 2 percentage points less. They're driving 20 to 25% less. And there are a number of reasons for that. And the economics are not so strong in that group. It wasn't that. It is the group that shares everything. So the idea of owning a car isn't terribly important. When I started driving in the 1960s and I got my 60 Chevy Impala with the big fins, that was a sign of freedom, and it was a sign of who I was. I identified with that. In 2015, younger people don't identify with a car. The sign of freedom is the smartphone. One of the biggest reasons that, and I've studied this over the years, that we can't get people out of cars, and they seem to be a very stubborn lot, is that many people don't understand how to use public transportation. It's a mystery to them, even when public transportation is close to their origins and destinations. Well, younger people, you could pluck a young person, a millennial, and place them in Paris or London or New Delhi or any city, and they will know the transportation network as well as a veteran, because their smartphone will tell them where the nearest bus stop is. It'll tell them to which train car to get into if they have a subway. It'll let them link up to Uber. So this generation has transportation anywhere, anytime, and they could figure it out, and they don't need a car. And suddenly the car is no longer a sign of freedom. It's a bit of an albatross for a segment of the population. You've got to carry this car around with you. If you want to have a few drinks, it's a real liability. But now you don't need that. And when I say the millennial shift, it's a shift of about 20 to 25%. It still doesn't mean that the majority of people won't be driving, but a shift of 20 to 25% is nothing short of revolutionary, and it could mean a lot of wonderful things for cities going forward.
Sam Schwartz, this desire to drive less, it's admirable, but if that ambition is going to become a real option, a real reality for people, you have to have a viable, reliable alternative. And you mentioned people being plugged into smartphones and apps and just literally being plugged in a way that perhaps older drivers aren't. Talk about the smartest and most effective steps that cities are taking right now to help alleviate this reliance on personal vehicles.
Cities really should be taking these steps, and it was disappointing to hear that Baltimore, that the light rail system has been killed, although it sounds like there's some additional money for bus transportation. That part of it is good. But a city that recognizes this is a city that will see its GDP grow. There's a close correlation between that. Venture capitalists will follow the young people that move to those cities. And the kinds of steps that cities can take is to make the walking environment much more pleasurable, to invest in its public transportation system, to have pedestrian oases such as we have in New York with Times Square. But I'm seeing that in almost every city that I visit, from Seattle to Los Angeles. It's to have a more equitable and more balanced form of transportation. So transit, walking, biking, those are three of the key ingredients. This younger generation really likes what we now call, this field didn't exist before, active transportation. They like to incorporate a healthy lifestyle and walking to destinations, biking to destinations. Even taking transit burns 20% more calories than if you drive in a car.
Sam Schwartz, you've driven a cab in New York City. You've served as that city's traffic commissioner. You've seen traffic at its ugliest, at its worst. And you seem like an undaunted, hopeful man. You have a vision for a better way in cities. Talk about this vision. Paint a picture for us of that ideal in your mind, a truly street-smart city. as you put it, a city? Is it a city where cars are non-existent? What are we striving for? How are we going to know when we get there?
Yeah, we're not going to suggest that cars be non-existent completely. But if you take a look at a number of cities that are experimenting with that, Oslo, Norway is now, as announced by 2019, its central business district will be car-free. But those cities will have land use patterns that allow for covering short distances rather easily, or covering land use rather easily. They'll be concerned more with accessibility than mobility. And what that means is where you work, where you go out to restaurants, where you shop, where you live, that they're all reasonably close to each other. And when they're not, they're linked by transit. So the smartest cities will be doing that. The smartest cities will be reclaiming a lot of roadway space that we built, excess roadway space. A lot of smart cities will rethink some of the highways that cut through their cities and, in fact, tear them down. New York City, we tore down the West Side Highway. Of course, it fell down before we tore it down. In San Francisco, the Embarcadero was removed post the earthquake. In Toronto, we're looking at removing the Gardiner Expressway through its downtown and waterfront region.
So, and you point out, Sam, that when these throughways collapse or are taken down, it actually doesn't increase congestion.
Yes, yes. There's the law of induced traffic, and it's been shown time and time again that when you add lanes and add roadways, and I just happened to see that in the governor's budget in Maryland, lanes are being added, that you induce the traffic, and you really don't solve the problem by having more lanes. And it also creates a maintenance headache and nightmare, which is part of the reason you're probably getting low grades from the American Society for Civil Engineers in maintaining your infrastructure. So what has happened is the reverse of that. What we've seen in both New York and San Francisco and a number of other places that have put roads on diets is the traffic did not get worse. There may have been an immediate impact and there may have been some repercussions, but in fact, those cities have thrived with less traffic but more people. London introduced congestion pricing, and it has less traffic but more people, and its economy is booming. Stockholm followed suit, and we're seeing Gothenburg and a number of other places around the world, Milan, that have introduced congestion pricing. So cities are recognizing that we swung the pendulum way too far in favor of the automobile. Now the pendulum is swinging back, and the younger people are recognizing it, and they're taking advantage of it. But not every city will be a winner going forward. There will be plenty of cities that just don't recognize that and don't invest.
Well, we'll talk about that political will here as the hour moves forward. Putting roads on a diet. I like that turn of phrase, Sam Schwartz. Sam Schwartz is the author of Smart Streets, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars. You're tuned to Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin in for Sheila Cass. Listeners, how does this vision sound to you? Is this an ideal worth striving for? Is it pie in the sky? Your thoughts and your questions are welcome at 410-662-8780 or by email at midday@wypr.org. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll bring the conversation home to our local streets and byways with Baltimore urban planner Klaus Philipson. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. Aaron Henkin in for Sheila Cast. And we're looking at the past, present, and future of urban transportation with Sam Schwartz, author of Smart Streets, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars. Again, your questions and comments are most welcome at 410-662-8780. 410-662-8780 or by email at midday@wypr.org. And joining us now here in studio is urban planner and architect Klaus Philipson. Klaus, welcome back to Midday.
Good afternoon.
So, Klaus, you've heard Sam Schwartz talk about smart streets, street smart cities, and the transportation planning that goes into them. How smart would you say Baltimore is by what you've heard of Sam's criteria?
Well, in the measures of transportation or in transit, particularly the alternative to the car, we are not super smart yet, and that's why we got a report card D. As an urban planner, I like to introduce also the second side to transportation, which is the urban form, the land use. And Sam makes in his book this point that streets are very stubborn. They are there for hundreds of years and really didn't change much. And that is true for cities, so for older cities. And you can call that the bones. And so Baltimore does have the advantage that it was created and initially grew in its core without the cars. So we do have the good bones that make it possible to bring a lively urban a city back to the days that Sam described, where pedestrians and other modes of transportation were somewhat on equal footing. And so our bones are here, but people that out there, listeners who think that we are kind of on crack here by saying, you know, we could get around without the cars, they often live in the suburbs. And so there the bones are not good. Anything that was developed when we had this car fixation is very car-oriented and not very easily served by any other ways of getting around. And so we need to really make this distinction, what the trends are and where they happen, because whatever is possible in the cities is not as easily to be achieved in the suburbs.
A city with good bones. I like that. That's the real estate agents use that too. So Baltimore's kind of a fixer-upper, but it's got good bones.
Yeah, we have principally a very walkable urban core, and many of the neighborhoods that were built in the 20s or so, they are also very walkable, even when they were streetcar suburbs that were built around the notion that you can walk to your nearest streetcar stop. So the inner ring suburbs, or even Catonsville or so, these streetcar suburbs, they are very much walkable, and they can principally be served by transit. And we need to talk about what type of transit and what the right form of transit is so that there is an alternative.
I know you had an opportunity, Klaus, to read Sam Schwartz's book, Street Smart. I wonder if you have any questions for Sam that particularly stood out for you as an urban planner.
Well, Sam is talking in the last chapter a bit about the onset of the self-driving car or the autonomous vehicle, and that could be a game changer. And he says that it could go this way or that way for cities. It could be a bane for urban development and for the renaissance of cities, in the sense that all of a sudden the commute and being stuck in a car isn't as unpleasant anymore, because the car drives itself and you can do your work while you, like you were, as if you were in transit. And that would kind of reinforce the dispersal model that we saw particularly after World War II, where because of the car everything got more and more far flung. And so that could all of a sudden have another boost if we have these self-driving automobiles. And the other potential is that the cities become actually much better places, because we would have much fewer of these vehicles around, which would be predicated on the notion that the car that you own is an obsolete model of transportation, because the car, when you own it, is 95% dormant. It sits around somewhere and does nothing. So you pay a lot of money, and you keep on paying it off in insurance and gasoline and all that stuff, and it does most of the time nothing. So it seems like that our current new generation and my generation, the baby boomers that made the millennials, you know, these two large cohorts are both kind of recognizing, hey, this is like really a dumb model. And so if the cars, the self-driving cars, are not owned anymore, and they are serviced, you can call them with your smartphone, and they come to you, and they are perpetually in motion, but then you would need much, much fewer of those, and you would not need all the parking spaces. And when you look at cities, how much space is devoted to parking the vehicles, that's a lot.
Sam Schwartz in New York. You've heard Klaus make mention of self-driving cars as a possible bane or a possible salvation here for congestion in streets. I mean, what's your take on this?
Well, we better get ready. We were mostly caught flat-footed with the rise of Uber and Lyft and all of the so-called transportation network companies. autonomous vehicles are heading our way. Tesla already is offering autonomous vehicles. There are various degrees of autonomy. If we are dumb, we're going to let the old model of car ownership, people own the autonomous vehicles, and we rely totally on autonomous vehicles, and increase sprawl, increase traffic congestion, and it won't really do anything for our quality of life. If we're smart, and if we're smart, we're going to, in our central cities, we're going to have autonomous vehicle lanes that could be 6 or 7 feet wide, and we could reclaim a lot of sidewalk or add bicycle lanes or take some other measures, beautify the area. If we're smart, we will start looking at transit systems that could become autonomous and offer double the transit service for the same price and the same amount of labor. I'm not looking at a reduction in labor. And also, if we're smart, we would introduce a pricing formula that would charge autonomous vehicles for using street space. Just imagine if you're going into a dense business district and you don't want to pay for parking. You tell your autonomous vehicle to just drive around and until you need it, and we'll have all these autonomous vehicles. There's the movie WALL-E, which gives us a great picture of what it could be like if everything was autonomous. Our legs would kind of disappear, and we'll lose the ability to stand up or walk. And there'll be lots of health implications as well. So we've got to be smart going forward, and I don't see much indication of that yet.
And I would say that smart means in this case also that we are not assuming that these autonomous vehicles would ever replace transit in major cities. So they may do that in the countryside or in small towns, that the autonomous vehicle becomes like a demand-based transit type of situation. But in cities, you don't get the volumes that you need to move people. And so we still need transit. And so therefore, I want to get back to the decision to not build the red line, that was not a smart decision, because you do need a robust transit system no matter how the future pans out with these AVs, the autonomous vehicles. And even when you talked about the consolation prize with the reform of the bus system, that when you are trying to do this, like in Houston, I think is sort of the model here, the drastic reform of the bus system in a very short time. And in Houston, they could do that because they also opened two light rail lines at the same time. So when you have all of a sudden less need for your buses and you have excess capacity, then you can reorganize the buses much better than when you don't have this. So now we are reorganizing the bus system, or the Hogan administration is set to do it and has put forth a set of criteria and objectives that are all very laudable, and has also put forth a concept that looks very good as on a map. That is much more logical than what we currently have as the system. And there is a lot of promise in that, so I would support that. It is not an alternative to the red line. It's not an alternative to a robust rail system, but it is something that should have been done anyway. We have 800 buses coming out every day, and to run them efficiently and to run them so that they are not redundant and that they go where people want to go and where you can reach jobs, provide access to the impoverished communities, that's all good.
Let me interrupt here, gentlemen, and say that, I mean, smart planning is just that, planning. If you do not have a government that's willing to put its money where its mouth is, you end up with a table full of great drawings and blueprints and schematics, and nothing changes. Let me ask you, challenge you to think about, what do the people in power, the people who hold the purse strings, need to fundamentally understand about the importance of public transportation? Why is it so easy for governments to deprioritize or just flat out ignore this need?
Well, there's an ideologue. Yeah.
Go ahead, Sam, in New York.
Sure. One of the problems is that we use the word subsidy when it comes to transit, and we don't use it to roads. And roads are subsidized to a great extent. And I think we have to change that mindset. But we're beginning to see it, and it's happening in red cities as well as blue cities. So Salt Lake City, which is run by a Republican mayor, is investing in public transportation, as is Oklahoma City, in which the mayor is tired of being labeled one of America's fattest cities, and he wants the public to be healthier. When a city understands that the gross domestic product of that city goes up as you invest in public transportation, there is a direct correlation between public transportation usage and GDP, you might then get the attention of the mayor. The same thing with venture capital. As transit goes up, venture capitalists are looking where the brains are. The brains are going to those places. We're being brought in, my consulting firm's being brought into places like Boise, Idaho, and Grand Rapids, Michigan, and other places around the country in which the mayors are recognizing that need. And they're all looking for innovation districts. Innovation districts or tech hubs are the kinds of places that attract the young people and attract the those innovative people. And they want walking environments. In Grand Rapids, I was meeting with the mayor, and there was a head of the real estate association there who was talking about the experience of trying to attract a tech firm to a warehouse district. And that warehouse district had all the parking in the world. And while the real estate agent is telling them all about that, the tech CEO, who's probably 23 years old, said, "Where do we park the bikes? Where's the train station?" If mayors, and we see to lesser extent governors, get that kind of message that this is healthy for the economy, then we'll be able to convince them to put their money where it's appropriate and smart.
That's the voice of Samuel Schwartz, former New York City traffic commissioner and author of Street Smart, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars, in studio here with me, Klaus Philipson, urban planner, architect, and traffic consultant here in Baltimore City. Klaus?
Yeah, this economic development argument goes both ways. It is broader than just the millennials and the folks that don't find it cool anymore to drive and or work in a suburban office park. It goes also into equity issues. And a city like Baltimore, with a lot of poverty and large pockets of communities that don't have access to jobs, transportation is the biggest element in terms of holding those communities down. And so therefore, the economically thriving city would invest in transit for both to attract the what is called the creative class that has a high flexibility and mobility and can choose between any place in the U.S., and they would certainly not go to a place where there is poor public transportation. And those that we have made being stuck in and dependent on transportation and have a very poor service for them. So investing in transit really elevates the entire city on both of these levels, and therefore it is really not smart to think that one can do this on the cheap. And unfortunately, our governor has thought that instead of spending $730 million matched up with federal funds, that he could do it with $135 million for this improved bus system, and that will be very hard to do.
Meanwhile, he's quite enchanted by the idea of a maglev train to D.C. We'll talk about that after the break, perhaps. On 88.1 WYPR, this is Midday. I'm Aaron Henkin, in for Sheila Cast, as we try to work through our collective hopes and frustrations about public transportation and smart city planning. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, listeners, the conversation is yours. Give us a call at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or email us at Midday@WYPR.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Aaron Henkin in for Sheila Cast. We're talking urban transportation and street smart cities this hour. How smart is Baltimore along these lines? How can it get smarter? Is there a political will out there to make it happen? Let us know what you think. The phones are open, 410-662-8780, and we're taking emails at midday at WYPR.org. We'll go straight to the phones and talk with Brian O'Malley, President, CEO of Central Maryland Transportation Alliance, the guy who gave us a D on our report card. Brian O'Malley, what have you got to say to us today?
Well, that's quite an introduction, but thank you for covering this topic. I think our report card says a lot of the things that Mr. Schwartz and Klaus and you have been discussing. We set out to grade the region from the perspective of employers, from the perspective of families and individuals who use the system. And for them, transportation isn't an end. It's a means to get where we want to go. And so the report card is measuring the things that will improve if our transportation does its job better. Things like your health and your environment, giving you choices, and growing the economy. And I was glad Salt Lake City came up. Mr. Schwartz brought that up. We found that we were comparing the Baltimore region to other regions around the U.S. And it was really interesting that in Salt Lake City, over the last two decades, they've aggressively invested in their public transportation, adding three new light rail lines, an 88-mile commuter train, a streetcar, bus rapid transit, expanding a downtown hub. And over that time, it's not surprising that access to jobs by transit got better, but it might be surprising to the listeners that access to jobs by driving got much better. The number of jobs you could get to in a 10- or 20-minute drive went up. And it's no surprise to anyone that here, the number of jobs over that period that you could get to in a short drive went down. It's harder to get the jobs by car. And so this idea that a dollar invested in a transit system is a dollar taken away from drivers is wrongheaded. It's a dynamic system, and a dollar that moves people more, invested in a project that moves people more efficiently, helps drivers as well.
Brian O'Malley, President and CEO of Central Maryland Transportation Alliance. We humbly accept the report card, and we thank you for your thoughts on the program today. Klaus, I'm going to let you take it from here.
Yeah, this actually, thanks to Sam for pointing out how important the smart streets are. Oftentimes very cheap to improve the situation. It doesn't cost a lot of money to make walking safer, to add bike lanes, to eliminate right turn on red that runs over pedestrians, to create more crosswalks, to eliminate parking restrictions during rush hour that makes people speed along the curb like a few inches away from the walking pedestrians. These are all measures that are very simple, and they cost practically nothing. They fall into the hands of Baltimore City, and unfortunately, we haven't done many of those. We will get a bike sharing next year, and we will have, hopefully, eventually, those bike corridors that the city has been talking about for years. And hopefully they will take these other measures, too. One-way streets should be eliminated. We have all the stuff that Mr. Schwartz describes in the book from the time of Robert Moses. Our guy was Barnes, and he did all this stuff is still here. We have too many traffic signals. We have too many one-way streets, too many rush hour restricted parking. All of that can be eliminated from one day to another, pretty much, and it would cost almost nothing.
That's Klaus Philipson, Baltimore Urban Planner. You heard him mentioning Sam Schwartz in his book. Sam is on the line with us from a studio connection in New York City. The book is called Street Smart, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars. Sam, you just heard us get our report card there, and you've heard Klaus's response. I mean, are we on the right track to improving our grade? What do we need to do best? Where does our homework lie?
Well, Brian gave us a pretty good clue in talking about Salt Lake City and how driving got better in Salt Lake City. It's how do you appeal to people that do think investing a dollar in transit is taking it away from the automobile, when in fact it is making conditions better for everybody? And I think that is key. There's also a chapter in my book called Tuxedos on the Subway, and that goes back to a class I took at the University of Pennsylvania in the late 1960s, in which the professor Vukan Vucic spoke about the Moscow subway system after talking about great subway systems of the world and how people ride the Moscow subway system and in tuxedos and gowns going to the opera. And he said, can you imagine that happening on a New York City subway? And it's when we invest in a public transportation system that attracts all economic classes, you get all economic classes clamoring for it. And so I think Klaus also pointed out the social equity aspects of a good transit system. And a good transit system is one in which we do have tuxedos on the subway, but we also are taking lower income people and increasing their job opportunities. And so I think both gentlemen are on the right track, and Klaus is right. A lot of this turnaround in a city can be done on the cheap. It doesn't take a lot of money. And the good news about it is you're not left with the infrastructure to maintain for all those years. We build more elevated highways or depressed highways or limited freeways. We're going to have to maintain those. And we haven't done a good job in the United States maintaining them. Eisenhower unleashed the Interstate Defense Network, a great public works program. But very few states are doing a good job at maintaining it. And we're going to see more failures like we saw with the I-35 bridge through Minnesota.
Sam Schwartz and Klaus Philipson, stand by just a minute. I'm going to turn the show over here to some emailers and callers. Email here, Tracy in Baltimore says, I think Baltimore's mayor recognizes the importance of transit, but our transit is run by the state, where many communities may not see a benefit to transit. How can Baltimore get the transit we need when programs are run by people who don't see a benefit? I guess that's more of an editorial comment than a question, or I guess I could say a rhetorical question. Let's go to the phones here and speak with Graham in West Baltimore. Graham, you're on the air.
Hi. I have one comment and one question. So I moved here in 2008 to be a part of Baltimore's awesome arts and music communities while pursuing a world-class education. 2012, I moved out here to the west side to be close to the Mondawmin Mall metro station. And to see the Red Line go was really hurt, and I think it was an act of class war. My question is, how can Baltimore take into its own hand building more light rail lines? How can the city finance it on its own?
That sounds like it might be a question for you, Klaus, as our local expert. Is there any way for the city to just wrest this from the state and deal with it on its own terms?
Well, there is always this discussion now, particularly when there's political change in the governor's mansion, whether one would be better off to run the transit system out of the city. But we do have to recognize that our metropolitan area has a transit system, not just Baltimore City, and that this transit system reaches into many jurisdictions, and that there are some advantages of having it run on a regional scale. You know, there are regional transit systems in Portland, for example, which is always used as a model, or in Denver, the transit investments there are regional compact. So I think this is important to stay regional. The city itself certainly doesn't have the financial capability. They did run the circulator system on their own, and they ran it into a deficit, although it is a very intelligent system in terms of being funded for the most part out of parking fees, surtax. So that was actually a very smart way. But, of course, the circulator was a complementary transit system, not a competing transit system.
Graham in West Baltimore, thanks for your call. 410-662-8780, the number to call to share your thoughts, your questions here on Midday. We go back to the phones now and hear from Monroe in Baltimore. Monroe, you're on the air.
Yeah. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I can remember when Baltimore had a decent transit system back in the late 40s, early 50s, but after General Motors, Firestone Tire and Rubber, and Phillips Petroleum and Standard Oil of Indiana got together to form a company called National City Lines, was taking over transit system to destroy anything on rails. One example was the North Avenue line, the number 13. National City Line says we want to convert to buses because it'll cost us $30,000 to do the repair work needed on the rails. When all was said and done and the Public Service Commission said go ahead, it wound up costing National City Lines over $60,000 to do that. And right now, Baltimore has basically a third-world transit system. Nothing connects to anything. You've got a subway, which was discussed in the 50s and 60s, that doesn't go anywhere and connect with anything. You have a light rail system that doesn't connect with anything. So something definitely has to be done. Get the buses off the road. There are trackless trolleys which use electricity. And not as General Motors said, their buses pollute less than streetcars do. So I'd like to listen to your reply on the radio.
Right. Thank you very much, Monroe, for your thoughts and your memories of happier days for public transit in Baltimore. Klaus, I'll let you go first, and Sam, stand by, and I'll let you chime in as well.
Well, certainly there are opportunities with new technologies like streetcars that run without wires to improve transit. But to just rely on streetcars would probably not work either. And again, it needs to be a regional approach to transportation. And we do need to invest and we need to build back. Certainly, when you look around the world, the cities that did never dismantle their streetcar system, like Philadelphia or Zurich in Switzerland, or you know, my hometown of Stuttgart, we kept these streetcars and they were modernized and they were much better. They are much better off today to have a connected system. So we need to rebuild. And we would like to say to Monroe, though, that the two rail systems that we have are not making a system. They are just two individual elements. But they certainly go to places and from places. So going to downtown and through all of downtown, going to Johns Hopkins and going to the growth center of Owings Mills is not bad. It is just so that two rail systems alone don't make a system. So the third would have been the beginning of a system. So they are just two individual lines right now.
All right, Klaus, thank you. Sam, I'm going to give you the final word here this hour.
Sure. I think Monroe did us a real service because he's giving us a history lesson. And there was a conspiracy, and General Motors, Firestone Tire, and all the others that Monroe mentioned were convicted in 1948 of destroying transit systems around the country. And perhaps 100 transit systems ultimately, most of them, if not all, were streetcar systems. Well, we have to learn from history, and we're facing a future in which Google has invested in Uber, and I call them goobers that we're going to be seeing around traveling on their own driverless vehicles. Amazon and others are getting into the act. Government needs to be smarter. We can't just sit on our hands and watch as technology, which is wonderful and could be used to really help us, or it could be used in a way to repeat what we saw in the 1930s and 1940s, destroying public transportation systems. So while I'm optimistic, I also add a word of caution. We've got to look out and have our eyes open to these technologies, and government has to play a very big role.
Cautious optimism, the last word of the day here on our program. I want to thank our guests, Sam Schwartz, author of Street Smarts, The Rise of Cities and the Fall of Cars. Also thanks to urban planner and architect Klaus Philipson of Archplan, Inc. And thanks to you, our listeners, for your calls and emails. Tomorrow's Veterans Day, Sheila Cast is going to talk with a veteran about the importance of bone marrow donation. Also, it's 100 years since Albert Einstein published his theory of general relativity. We'll talk about that, too. For 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station, I'm Aaron Henkin. Thanks for listening. Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Melody Simmons and Connor Graham. The Midday intern is Adam Droneberg. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.